Those Who Persevere Under Trial, the seventh talk in a series entitled Those Who Belong to God, was presented by Ron Julian on October 13, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We have been in a series about the different ways that the Bible describes the people of God. We took a little week off last week from that, but I'd like to pick up with that again. I would say we've been talking about the way the Bible describes the Christian, but actually I think what we're learning and exploring here is that that can kind of be a misleading way to talk about this a little bit. There are a lot of funny ideas around about what that word Christian means. I know in my family growing up, the idea of a Christian, if it ever came up at all, would be someone who lived a moral life. A Christian is somebody who's trying to do the right thing, as opposed to someone who doesn't care. There is a more popular idea, I imagine, that a Christian is someone who believes all the right doctrines about Jesus. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, then you're a Christian. And that's true enough. I mean, we can use the word that way. The world is filled with people who are Christian in their religion. But what I've been trying to get across is that the Bible paints a different picture for us of what it means to be a child of God. There is a shift in the way we look at the world that marks us as belonging to God. And we've been trying to look at some of the ways the Bible describes that shift. I think it has to do with seeing myself differently, understanding that I am not as good as I would like to pretend that I am. It involves seeing God differently, understanding that He is good, that He is trustworthy, that He is my creator, which implies, back looking at me again, that I am a creature. I'm not the center of the universe. It involves coming to see that the things that this world has to offer are not really enough to satisfy me as a human being, and that, in fact, what God has promised in the gospel offers the only hope that my humanity is really going to be fulfilled. And ultimately it has to do with solving the problem of sin and entering into what we might call righteousness or holiness, all of that. Being a Christian, believing that Jesus is the Christ, is meaningful, and it's only meaningful to the extent that it is a reflection of that change of heart. Now, having said that, making a fairly substantial claim for what it means to be a Christian, and that, in fact, there are a lot of people running around in the world who would call themselves Christians who, in many ways, have demonstrated that this change of perspective has not happened to them, is there any way that I can know that I, in fact, am one of those people who, in whom this change of heart has happened? Is there some mark of the work of God that I can look at and say, yeah, that seems to indicate that I'm one of those? And I think that the Bible indicates to us that, yes, there is a way that I can begin to know this. In the past few weeks, I've described the people of God as those who love God, fear God, humbly admit their own sin, who do not love the world, those who have repented. Well, what we're talking about today has everything to do with how I come to know myself as one of those people. Because I think that one of the clear teachings of the Bible is that the people of God are those who persevere under trial. Now, this is very common. I mean, anyone who's heard me teach much, you've probably heard me talk about this a lot, because I'm convinced that this is one of the central ideas that we encounter in the Bible. One of the most fundamentally important ideas that we can come to grips with if we're trying to understand what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be a believer? What is the life of a Christian like in this world? And I think that really this theme is at the heart of a lot of the stuff that we find in the Bible. Some of it explicitly dealing with it, but this issue is kind of in the wings with a lot of things that are being talked about. Because I would argue that the teaching of Jesus, the letters of the apostles, when they're exhorting and imploring the people that they're talking to or writing to turn around, to look at life a different way, to turn away from whatever foolishness they happen to be involved with at the time, that in essence, those appeals are, they are like little mini trials, little tests of the heart of the people that are being addressed. The issue is this going to make sense to you or not? Do you see how you've gone the wrong way? Or are you blind and will you insist on your blindness to the end? That's, in essence, what the, when we look at the New Testament, that's what's happening there an awful lot of the time, is an appeal to us, to particular people at the time, but by extension to us, to rethink it, to reconsider our lives and say, is this going the right way or not? And ultimately, whether we are interested in making that reevaluation, whether we're perceptive, whether we hear that there's something there that we need to hear and respond to, that has everything to do with our own state before God. Now, we're talking about perseverance in faith, perseverance under trial. In the Christian world out there, there are several models that people have for how we put together the idea of perseverance on the one hand and assurance on the other. Assurance being that the issue of, can I know that I'm a believer? Can I have some assurance that I in fact belong to God? How do perseverance and assurance work together? One model that is out there is perseverance in faith is a necessity, and therefore assurance is impossible. And it makes a certain amount of sense. The idea is, okay, well, since you have to persevere in faith, you may be saved today, you may have faith today and belong to God, but since you have to persevere, there's no guarantee that you're going to have that same faith tomorrow. So I don't care what's true about you today, there's no guarantees that tomorrow is going to be the same, and so the best we can do is we'll just wait till the end. Let's see how it happens when we all cross the finish line, and till then, the best I can do is urge you not to give up, because if you do, you're in trouble. So one model would suggest that there is no assurance possible, really, because perseverance is essential. There is another model, which is essentially 180 degrees around from that, which has argued, yes, we can be assured that we're believers, because what is a believer? A person is a believer who one time in their life said, yes, Jesus is the Christ. That's all it really takes. Now, if that's true, then, since perseverance is not necessary, as long as I say it once and then after that, I could go just about any direction. If I mess up, if I go off in evil and unbelieving directions, then I'm not going to get my rewards, they would argue, but my salvation has been assured. And so, yes, I can have assurance that I'm a believer, because all I have to do is, you know, it's the old stake behind the barn model. Go out, on the day you accept Jesus, go out and plant your stake in the ground that says, I accepted Jesus on this day. And if you're ever wondering whether you're saved or not, you go out behind the barn and look at the stake and say, oh yeah, on that day I accepted Jesus, so that must mean I'm a believer. Well, you can see that how these two ideas are just 180 degrees around. One is saying perseverance is essential, so assurance is not possible. The other is saying perseverance is not essential, and so assurance is possible. Well, there's a third model, I think, and it is the model I believe is biblical. This is what the Bible is teaching, and that is the model that brings both of them together, that says, yes, perseverance is necessary, and yes, assurance is possible. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit this morning. I want to start with very quickly looking at the parable of the sower in Matthew 13. All very familiar passages, I would imagine, that we're going to look at today. at least for some of you who've been around for a while. Starting in verse 3 of Matthew 13. And he was standing on the and he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, "Behold, the sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seeds fell beside the road, and the birds came and ate them up. And others fell upon the rocky places, where they did not have much soil. And immediately they sprang up, because they had no depth of soil. But when the sun had risen, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And others fell among the thorns, and the thorns came up and choked them out. And others fell on the good soil, and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. He who has ears, let him hear." And the nice thing about this parable is that we have something of an explanation from Jesus about what it's about. So let's jump down to verse 18 and see how it is that Jesus explains the parable. "Hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is the one on whom seed was sown beside the road." So Jesus is making an analogy here between that hard-packed ground behind, alongside the road, where the seed is not even really going to get into the soil and the birds just come and eat it away, as a very common experience, something that we ought to understand fairly easily, the idea that many people, upon hearing the proclamation of the gospel, find it uninteresting, they don't understand it, they don't want to understand it, it's something they can easily pass by, and they do. There's very little debate or argument about what kind of a thing Jesus is describing there with the first soil that he describes. "And the one on whom the seed was sown on the rocky places, this is the man who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no firm root in himself, but is only temporary. And when affliction or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he falls away." So here we're talking about an initial belief, but one that is shallow, one that is not deep-rooted in the heart. Difficulties come, and the faith dies. In Luke, when we see this parable, we see it described as times of testing coming upon the person, something to shake and challenge, just how deeply are you committed to this? And so here's a picture of someone who is not deeply committed to it. It's interesting at first, but when it actually starts to be difficult to be a believer, that faith is no longer interesting, not willing to pay the price. Okay, "And the one on whom seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful." Here, again, we have an initial belief that's being talked about, but now we're talking about divided loyalties. There are other things that ultimately become more interesting than the promise of the gospel. Matthew describes them as the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches. In Luke, we see the phrase, the pleasures of this life. So, with the second and third soil, we sort of have, on the one hand, opposition, which exposes the shallowness of the commitment of faith, and on the other hand, we have competition, other things that come along that compete with the gospel and ultimately win out, choke out that initial interest, because ultimately the heart is set on other things than what the gospel has in mind. Those are some of the things that we have seen in the weeks previous here, when Jesus in John talks about the different kinds of things that draw people away from him. Those are the sorts of things that we've been looking at. Finally, then, we come to the one on whom seed was sown on the good soil. This is the man who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. So ultimately, there's this final soil, which is true belief, which perseveres ultimately and grows. There is an initial interest which ultimately matures and grows into something substantial. Now, it seems to me that there are three important ideas in this passage that I want to bring out. First of all, what's very striking about the analogy that Jesus is making is that if we're going to talk about belief as being the hallmark of the child of God, what's interesting is that clearly in this parable, belief is not enough. Because three out of the four soils are believers. They're people who express a belief and an interest in this message of the kingdom when they hear it. But only one of them yields the desired result. The second thing is that perseverance is essential to this picture. In fact, the word perseverance is even used in there. The idea that ultimately this faith is something that has to survive the world that it's living in. It has to survive against opposition, and it has to survive against the competition that's out there. And that's the whole point of this picture, is that there are different things that could ultimately put out that initial interest. And the faith that is real, the faith that is genuine, the faith that ultimately is what faith ought to be, is the kind of thing that is deeply rooted enough that it can survive. And finally, what seems to me to be the most important thing that we come out of this parable with is the idea that it is the prior state of the heart that determines the response to the gospel. I mean, that's what's so striking about this analogy. In a sense, sowing the seed out on the different kinds of soil is a kind of a test. In one sense, you're doing it because you want to get a crop, but it has the impact at the same time of being a long-term test of what kind of soil have we got here? What am I dealing with? It depends. Do the birds eat the seed? Do the plants grow up immediately but wither in the sun? Do the plants grow up but then are choked out by other plants, thorns and so on, that compete and ultimately kill it? Or does it survive and grow into something? Is there the crop in the end? In Luke, we see Jesus describing this person that is represented by the final soil as one who has an honest and good heart, which has been a very important and striking phrase for me, something that I've been thinking about a lot. Not good as in no sins. I mean, that it would make no sense for Jesus to say that the person that hears the gospel and responds to it the way they're supposed to is the person in whom there are no sins, there is no evil. I mean, there isn't anyone around like that. Everyone who's being saved is a person who is a sinner and who is evil. That's why we need to be saved in the first place. But there is a kind of goodness about the heart of the person who responds to the gospel, in that they respond to the gospel. There is a truth there, and their heart responds to that truth. They see it for what it is. Jesus can describe that as being honest and good, true and good. The idea being, unlike the shallow, the seeds that are sown in the rocky soil where it's shallow, there is a depth, the commitment to that truth goes deep. And unlike the seed that's thrown among the thorns, ultimately the heart is not divided. Ultimately, time is going to show that the commitment of the heart is on the things promised in the gospel, and that is at bottom what my life is about. It's that sort of a person who is the one with the honest and good heart, and that's the one, ultimately, that is the child of God. This is the one whose response to the gospel has shown itself in a persevering, maturing way that ultimately shows the work of God, shows what that person is made of. Well, it seems to me that in that story itself, then, we can start to see the dim outlines of how perseverance and assurance could come together. What if my faith comes up against some opposition in this life? Or what if my faith comes up against some competition in this life? Either it's difficult to be a believer, or there is something else that is drawing me away. the fact that in the face of real opposition and real competition over time, I would continue to follow Jesus, even in the face of such pressures and distractions, says something about the work of God in my heart. Now, something real is at stake, and I am in a position to see whether I, in fact, am committed to this gospel the way I said I was when I went forward. I can experience perseverance in the midst of those things which test my faith. Perseverance is not just something at the end. It's not just the question, are you going to cross the finish line? But it's a quality of my heart now. Ultimately, is my belief and trust in God stronger than the pull of this world on me? And that's something I can start to understand now, because the world is pulling on me now. And there are going to be those times when I am going to have to sort out here and now, in the face of real issues, what it is I'm about. And it's in those places, ultimately, that I can come to know myself as someone whose heart is true and good. Now, I think that's specifically what Paul and James and Peter, in three very similar passages, argue about the way God deals with us as Christians. We'll turn to Romans 5, but the other passages say very similar things. Again, very familiar passage to many of us, probably. Certainly, if you've done any listening to me, it is, because I talk about this all the time. One of my favorite passages in the Bible, one of the passages that has had the most impact on the way I think about things, I think, is Romans 5. And basically, we have this progression of ideas. Let me read what Paul says here in verse 3. And not only this, but we also exult, we also boast in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope. And hope does not disappoint you. There's this progression. This progression shows up in a similar way in the first chapter of James. It shows up in a similar way in the first chapter of 1 Peter. In fact, we talked about it when we were going through 1 Peter several months ago. It starts out, all of them start out with the strange idea that there is something desirable about troubles and tribulations. Tribulations, testing, difficulties, I mean, these are the kinds of things that are being talked about. And each of them suggests that there's something desirable about them. And right there is an idea, I think, that we have to come to terms with. Many of us are aware of attempts in the Christian culture to deal with this kind of thing that don't seem to work somehow, and so we may be tempted to just sort of eliminate it altogether and say, well, this can't be a serious idea. What I'm thinking of is those people who have faced into loss, who are facing personal loss, grief, suffering in their life in one way or another, and they sort of feel called upon to plant a big smile on their face and go around saying, it's okay. No, I'm, you know, praise God, I'm suffering. Praise God, everything is terrible. Praise God, they're dying right and left. I mean, that somehow we have gotten the idea that is what we're being called on to do. And I don't think that I'm setting up a straw man or anything there. At least in my experience, I have seen people who have tried to face into the tragedies in their life and the loss in their life by pretending that they were not hurting, and they were thinking that somehow that's what they were called upon to do, that somehow being a Christian provides some kind of supernatural anesthesia that protects us from pain in the middle of loss. Well, if you look at that and come to think, you know, ultimately I can't fake that. That's not something I'm going to be able to do. We may be tempted to think, well, then this can't have much meaning, can it? If I'm not supposed to plaster a fake smile on my face in the midst of suffering, then why does James say, count it all joy when you encounter various trials? Or why does Paul say that we boast in our tribulations? Why is it that Peter seems so convinced that something incredibly valuable and desirable is happening to us in the midst of our trials? Well, each of them, I think, basically goes on to say that the reason that our troubles and trials are desirable is because they are the situation in life in which I am called on to persevere, where I am called on to hold on to my faith. This is the place where the pressure is. This is the place where I'm being drawn away, or this is the place where to stay where I am is to face opposition and suffering. In that place, then, the issues of my faith are being tried. It's not just crossing the finish line that's at the stake. The issue is not, where are you on the day when Jesus comes back? Perseverance is a quality that emerges at those times when I must persevere. It's when I face the question, do I still want this or not? It is not easy. It is not pretty. It is often very painful. The kind of persevering that we're talking about here ultimately, I think, is done with much suffering, with much grumbling often, because if it were not something difficult that we were facing, something that really mattered to us was on the line, then it wouldn't really be a trial. I mean, it's easy to be long-suffering in the middle of things that don't bother me. I mean, what does it say about me when I can be patient in the midst of happiness? I mean, I'm ecstatically happy, and it's okay. I can keep going. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. I hope you can. Knowing myself, I'm not so sure, actually. I'm not sure that ecstatic happiness would be enough, even for me. So, but the idea is that the whole point of a trial is that it is trying. It is shaking me. And if it's going to shake me, then that means that it's hitting me where I live. It's hitting me at a place where something is at stake for me, which means that it's going to be ugly. It's going to be difficult. I may be tempted in the middle of it to tell God to get lost. And in fact, you know, I can't prove this from the Bible, but I just know the people that I have talked to and looking at my own experience is a very, very common theme to see people saying that basically I came this close to dumping the whole thing. So we're not talking about some little temptation comes along and I victoriously dodge it. Ta-da, I'm a Christian. Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about being shaken to the point where it's looking really bad. Ultimately, I think, that's the sort of thing that tries us. What does that lead to? They all use similar language, a set of words that revolves around the idea of proof. When you go to test something, the idea is you want to see, is it true or not? And so ultimately, the process of being tested, of going through trials, is intended to yield a certain kind of proof. It's intended to show, is this person in fact a child of God or not? But what's striking in these passages is that this proof that emerges is not just something that happens down the line when Jesus comes back, but it is something that emerges in the midst of and out of the trials themselves now in this life. So this proof that we're talking about really is another word for the kind of assurance that we were asking about earlier. How do I come to know myself as a person of God? Well, at least one way that the Bible describes is by going through the fire, ultimately, I come out with an ultimate understanding that I am a person who has a faith that can survive the fire. And it's that's the kind of thing that you can't fake. It's not a plastered-on smile. It's not sort of coming to this grim resolution that I need to go out and do good things for people. We're talking about being shaken to the very core. Who am I? What am I about? And finding out at the end of it that I seem to be about the promises of God. The very thing that I wanted to know about myself is coming true before my eyes. I'm seeing it happen. Perseverance is not primarily about hanging in there for a long time. I mean, there are many Pharisees, I'm sure, of Jesus persevered in their Phariseeism brilliantly to the end of their lives. But what was the point of that? I mean, they persevered in hanging on to a lie. They persevered in believing what they wanted to believe because it was so attractive to them, in spite of the fact that it wasn't true. That's not what we're talking about. And since I would say that the Christian world that we live in, the Christian culture that we're aware of, is by no means free from the kind of Phariseeism, the kind of self-righteousness that Jesus and Paul spoke out so strongly against, the fact that somebody would persevere in such self-righteousness is not any indication of anything either. So we're not just saying, hey, the one who will still raise his hand when you ask, do you believe in Jesus at the end, that's the believer. That's not what I'm saying. What we're talking about is a very personal experience, I think, where I and God are sort of facing off, where I am being confronted with the question, do I really trust this God? Is what he has promised me worthwhile to me? Because the fact is that right now I'm not getting out of life what I was looking for. What am I going to do with a God who is not giving me what I was looking for out of life? I hope it's clear. I mean, you just turn on the TV and watch all the Christian television, and the message I keep hearing over and over again there is God is the one who will give you what you're looking for. But when I look at the Bible, it seems to me that what the Bible is teaching is God is going to thwart the worldly desires of his people for their own good. Yes, he's going to give us what we're looking for if at bottom what we're looking for is the goodness, the righteousness, the holiness of the kingdom of God, to come to know God, to come to be like him. If that's what I'm looking for, then yes, he is going to give me the desire of my heart. And he is working on that right now. But that's part of the reason why he finds it so important to shake us now. Said, you guys, you are so easily distracted. You have got to get your eyes cleared up. Think about what life is really about. Think about it. In fact, let me send you some stuff your way to make you think about it, because I know you don't want to think about it, but you're going to have to, because you're not going to be able to dodge this issue. When you're facing into the loss of the thing you most wanted, you're not going to be able to dodge the question of what is it that really makes life satisfying, and who is this God, and what is he about? Then Paul says that the ultimate result of this process is hope. That is, and what I understand him to be saying is that now in this life, this process of being tested strengthens my hope. My hope is an eager expectation that the truths of the gospel are going to come true for me. My hope that I am going to share in the glory of God, as he describes in Romans 5 there. This hope comes home to me because the process of testing brings it home to me. Because it clarifies my vision, it shows me what's really at stake, and I come to see myself as a person who wants the promises of God. I see more clearly what they are, and I know myself as somebody who wants them. And that's a very valuable thing to know. And so my hope is strengthened because I have seen what God is doing in me in the midst of those trials. There are a lot of different kinds of things that we might picture in terms of what a trial of faith looks like. The issue is, you know, all of these things we've been talking about. Do you love God? Do you trust God? Do you fear God? Do you know yourself as a sinner? Do you love this world, or have you seen through it and seen that what God is promising is better? Those are the kinds of things that get tested in the midst of trials. Maybe for one person, a trial is about coming to terms with the reality of his or her own sin. That at heart, I'm really attracted to a certain picture of myself as a good guy. And maybe the trial that I'm facing is coming face to face with the reality that I am not a good guy, and I can't pretend anymore that I am. Or maybe for someone else, it would be facing into the loss of something that was incredibly meaningful and important. And so the issue is, is this world and what it offers as important to me as what God has promised? I mean, there are many, many different ways, and for each one of us, the one who created us knows best those places to go where real things are on the line for us. Ultimately, what we're talking about here is the fact that God is real, the promises of God are real, and my reaction to those promises is a real thing. I mean, either ultimately I am a person who has embraced these things or I am not. But it's the sort of thing that can only emerge over time, sometimes a very long time. But the idea that we're being asked to embrace here is that ultimately it is a desirable thing to know yourself as a person who is destined for the kingdom of God. That's why Peter can use that language about, you know, gold tested in the fire, more precious than gold tested in the fire. I mean, if the most valuable thing there is the knowledge of God, to know Him, to be blessed by Him, to enter into the things that He has promised for His people, then the most valuable thing that could happen to me in this life is to come to know myself as a person who is a part of that. But it all hangs together. The suffering, the trials, they can't really have any significance. I can't rejoice in them. I can't boast in them. I can't see it as something more precious than gold if I haven't started to see that the issues involved are issues that involve things of great worth and importance. I can't count it all joy when I encounter various trials until I have started to get a picture of what important and wonderful things are at stake. So it kind of grows up together, I think. Ultimately, to rejoice in trials is to come to that place where the process of being tried has matured my vision to the place where I'm starting to understand and see what's at stake. And oftentimes, I think, ultimately, rejoicing in trials is something that we do in hindsight, looking back and saying, ultimately, that was worthwhile. It was difficult, but in the end, what it has done for me is something that I wanted to have done. Okay, well, I could go on and on, but maybe I should give you a few minutes to ask questions and comment. This is a big, big topic. A lot involved with it.
One of the things Philip Johnson was talking about in the October Fuss was the challenge to Christian educators in a secular environment to, you know, you're not supposed to say anything about design, for instance, and yet you're teaching a class where that would be a very logical thing to point out to the students and what you do. And he said that you have to pick your battles. You don't want to walk into the machine gun fire unless, you know, for no reason or whatever.
Right.
And I, on the one hand, I recognize the truth of what he's saying. There's no point if you can't swim in trying to get a, you know, help a drowning person, because you're no. I mean, it's just a gesture. On the other hand, that kind of striking out, if you think there's the least possible chance of helping the drowning person, is an indication of your value of them. And so I guess what I was wondering is, how do you, well, I think probably all of us are in situations like that, analogous to that, where, you know, is this a trial? I mean, there is something at stake. If I would like to speak up, if I do speak up, I'm going to feel it. If I don't speak up, it's probably not because this isn't an opportunity to speak up, but because I'm afraid of what's going to happen. So I guess my question is that a trial? What does it mean when I back down from situations like that where it's going to cost me? Does it always mean my faith is suspect? And are there any good reasons, or how would you describe a situation in which a Christian could do something like that, yet it would not say something bad about his faith?
Right. Well, you know, you can tell when your audience has gotten to the place where they probably don't need you anymore, when they are asking you questions that you have absolutely no idea what the answer is to, and it would probably be better to answer them themselves. And that's my situation here. I don't know. I'm not belittling your question. It's a very good question. I don't know how to answer it. Part of the reason, I'm just speaking honestly, part of the reason I don't know how to answer it is that one of the struggles of my life has been fear. I mean, I'm a coward. I really am. My family could testify to the reality of this, that I am, in fact, a coward. And by the grace of God, at times I have managed to overcome it. But the fact is that I'm still haunted by many situations where I feel like my fears led me to not do something that I should have done. So I am really tempted. See, I don't trust my own judgment when it comes to these things. I think that you're right, that there are those places where it's just wise to recognize that there's really nothing I can do. And you know, ideally, if I saw clearly enough to be able to say, well, you know, in fact, I think I'm just going to make things worse, then, you know, love would demand that I keep out of it. And I think that there are those situations, but I would suggest to you that I'm not a good guide to when they are. In fact, I'm sort of watching you all to see, you know, what are they doing when they get in this situation, and hoping that I can emulate you sometimes, because it's a difficult question for me. Logan.
It brings up the question of what does it mean to be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove?
Right.
What did Jesus mean when he talked about casting your pearls before swine?
Right.
Because I relate very well with what you're castigating yourself for. I am a coward, both a moral coward and a social coward. And I, oftentimes at work, I feel like I have an opportunity dropped in my lap to tell someone the truth, and there's this voice in my ear says, you want to lose your job? You want to alienate management? I mean, you want to say something out loud that someone's going to complain about? And I'm stuck. I feel like I'm stuck. And sometimes I feel unfaithful about that. But
I have to say that the picture of trials that I'm trying to paint here, it may at times come down to one black and white, here it is on the line issue, but, and I hope this is not a cop-out, but speaking as a coward myself, I find great comfort in the picture of Peter denying Jesus. I mean, this is exactly what Jesus said, you know, if you deny me before men, I will deny you before the Father. And that's exactly what Peter did. He said, no, I don't even... He's swearing. He's angry and swearing. I don't know him. Will you leave me alone? I do not know this man. Well, I mean, you know, those are my kind of nightmares, if that's the sort of thing that I would find myself doing sometime. But the fact is that that moment of fear, I mean, it wasn't really debatable whether he ought to have done that or not. There's no justification for it there. But the fact is that that didn't tell the whole story about Peter. And so I think ultimately our confusion at those kind of spots that you're talking about doesn't tell the whole story about us either. Especially if we're in there, which I think you are, Logan, and I hope that I am, struggling at least to try to understand what ought this look like. And I may not get it right all the time, but And sometimes it may be fear that sort of, you know, I find the convenient answer to be, I don't guess I need to say anything. I think that's probably true of us, but that's not really what I'm talking about. I mean, it's a more fundamental, if I find myself in the midst of those situations, sort of, instead of wrestling with what should I do here, finding it more convenient to just sort of, you know, to just drug out somewhere somehow and forget about it and just kind of treat my faith as if it was not anything that needed to have any impact on the way I live. Now that's when I think you should start worrying. Okay, there are a bunch of other hands up. Let's see. Was something back there, and then we'll come. No, I guess go ahead, Christine.
I was wanting to underline something that you already said. I was thinking talking about what this would have been like had I heard it, or when I did hear it years ago. And I thought it would have been very discouraging to me, because I really didn't understand what was inside of the words of these passages, especially like in James and Romans.
Yeah.
Because the only alternative I really knew was you've just got to plaster a smile
right
on your face.
Right.
And it didn't really have a lot of meaning to me what perseverance and proven character and hope, what that was about.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's where probably a lot of people here, a lot of people who are struggling with really understanding what you're saying. And I think it's hopeful to know that over years, over being crunched a zillion times, over being humbled, eventually those words have more meat than anything else, more substance, they're more tangible than anything else that I know.
Right.
But that happens as a miracle of being, of going through it so many times.
Right. No, I really think that's right.
I know in the midst of getting there, I've done terrible things to myself, like make myself very sick, or really beat up my husband, or done a lot of really awful things in my lack of understanding, in my kicking against wanting the very thing that God wants me to have.
Right.
So it's kind of an encouragement that if you don't get it, I think that's our God's commitment to us, to help us get this new language, which is Japanese.
Right, right. No, yeah, that's right. And these passages, I find these passages very encouraging, but I don't think that they're going to make sense, and I don't think they will be encouraging to us until, just like what you said, until you've had an opportunity to wrestle with it some and see actually how it plays itself out in life. One more question? Okay, Stan.
I'd like to readdress Margaret's inquiry and hers and Logan's concern and yours as well. You each took a piece of information delivered by the speaker, and you looked at it from a negative point of view. Look at the opportunity I might have had at work, or what about the drowning person I could have? What about the speaker's intent? What about the positive of this? I hope I don't sound like the devil's advocate, but I think if there'd be times when Logan would be unwise to speak up in a situation of limited value, that would be indeed casting a pearl into the horse one. Why don't we look at it from the positive point of view that we have to make decisions about issues and their importance? Like I would say, Margaret, how well you responded to a political issue 1 or 2 years ago, and how she investigated and worked so hard at understanding the issue of homosexuality in our faith. And how important that was, and how significant that was, and how it deserved her effort. Why can't we talk just a few minutes about making those decisions, or the positive side?
Well, no, I agree with you, Stan. I mean, the reason I emphasized it the way I did is because Margaret was couching the question in terms of this issue of how do I think about my faith being tried, and what does it say about me? And I agree. It can be a wise thing. I mean, it is a wise thing to pick and choose what I'm going to say and when I'm going to say it. And that, I mean, we're not called to just sort of blurt out everything we think every time and it is clear that somebody else might not agree with it or something like that. And so you're right. That can be the right way to go and an indication of a certain amount of wisdom and perspective on our part. I'm just saying, I recognize that tension at that spot and the fear that the real reason I'm not saying anything is because I know that I'm gonna get blasted if I do. And I recognize that as a tension that I work with. But you're right, the answer can be I really not only I don't need to say anything, but I shouldn't say anything. And I think sometimes that's right.
What I mean is that leaves it on a positive approach, and we're going to learn from the times, darn it, all that was an opportunity, I missed it, and you're waiting for it the next time it happens. It's kind of a learning experience.
Well, yes.
And I just wanted to set the tone of evaluation and perception and appreciating the many positive opportunities where it really does happen, and I respect the fact that the question was asked in deference to those unusual opportunities. And I just thought for a minute, rather than looking at just those, let's take a moment and pause. What was the meaning of what was said?
And if we're going to talk about the positive side of it, I mean, the fact is, I think that, I mean, speaking for myself, at the same time I'm talking about, and, you know, You don't have enough time to hear all of my various failures one way or another, but the fact is that I would look at myself, my life, and see the process of testing that's being described here as working itself out, and that I actually do see the work of God. I mean, I see the perseverance that is being described here. So ultimately, my stance in the middle of this is positive, and so I think it is a good and valuable thing, and it yields really important stuff. Okay, we're a little late, so I'll stop us here.